Hi everyone, I am Stephen. I'm a recovering meth addict. I identify as an alcoholic and an addict. Thank you for the committee, all those or whoever was involved in asking me to speak. I was telling my friends yesterday that many of you could probably tell my story, but I never apologize if you've already heard it, because so far I'm not willing to go out and get a new one. And I'm very, very grateful for that. But my sobriety date is July 21st, 1990. 26 years, 10 months, and some days. Thank you. Definitely by the grace of my higher power and your support. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees. My sponsor is not my higher power. I have a higher power that I pray to, and I ask my higher power, please guide my sponsor as he is working with me. And I encourage my sponsees, whatever form their higher power comes in, to ask their higher power to guide me as I'm working with them. Because the reality of it is, I can be the next person offering you a drug or a drink. I really understand when it says all we have is a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. And I have given some really sick opinions in my sobriety to sponsees. The reason why I do that practice is not because my sponsor did it, but when I was turning 10 years sober, I got sober in Southern California. You know, I was there, like I said, I got sober in 90. I was there when Bill, along with Don, and they started Crystal Meth Anonymous. But my sponsor at the time, I was telling him about the party my friends were putting together for my 10-year anniversary. And he looked at me and very calmly and clearly said to me, Alcoholics Anonymous is no longer working for me. I am drinking, and I don't care who you tell that to. And so quickly, a lot of things went through my head. The first thing was, I have told this man in detail, not vague, in detail, the shit that I did out there. And I hope he doesn't get drunk and go blab it. It was not, oh my God, I hope he's okay. I was like, I hope he doesn't go blab my shit. You know? The second thing that I started to think, well, if he's not an alcoholic or an addict, maybe, and I could hear myself saying, I call my higher power truth, whether it's God, whatever it is for you, but I can hear myself asking my higher power, please burn into my consciousness the fact that I know I am an addict and an alcoholic. And I didn't have to follow him out. I didn't have to go to a meeting and constantly use the burning desire to talk about his decision. But I really did get the part of one of the three pertinent ideas that probably no human power can relieve our addiction, our alcoholism, our drug addiction. And so, I got that. So that's where I developed that practice. And if you're new or if you've been here for a while, I have found in my time here, some of the things that helped me the most or helped me in addition to the book are the experiences and the situations that I got out there. So just really quickly, crystal meth was my drug of choice. And I've shared that before, that what I mean by that, if every single thing was on a table and you said, Stephen, you get one, you know, I would pick meth. But if meth was not there, I would pick something else. And if that was not there, I would keep going. So I don't use any mind-altering drug, because when I first got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in NA before CMA was there, I would go to meetings and I would say, hi, I'm Stephen. I'm an addict. I didn't consider myself an alcoholic. And the reason why I didn't consider myself an alcoholic, because when I compared the shit I did drunk compared to the shit I did on speed, no problem, drink, you know? But it didn't take me long to realize that every time I had, it wasn't a matter of if, but when, I would drink, that conviction would go away and I would pick up. So I don't do anything. I used to go, well, I didn't have a problem with this, I don't have a problem with that. And anything that alters my mind eventually, I will reach for what I love, which would be meth. So I'm just gonna quickly get to some of the things that I'm comfortable sharing with you now that I swore when I got here I would take to my grave. Because when I got into the rooms, I'm like, I am an addict and well, no, let me go back from here. I was in a relationship, another one, and I could remember, I met this guy on 976, that was the sex phone line. And I love 976. You know, because I was awake and I had a lot to say. And I was very creative and I could paint a very vivid picture. And I remember him saying, "Hey, when are we going to meet?" And I'm all like, "Meet?" I'm like, "You don't meet people off this line." And the reality of it is, I don't know if I had told him I was a blonde surfer or if I was black, or because I was many different things on that phone. It all depended on my high and whatever I thought you needed to keep you on the phone. So he described me, and I'm like, wow, that was an honest meeting, I guess. And see, we were in a relationship, and what that relationship was, he had my home number. It wasn't cell phones then. He had my home number, and I had his. So that was a relationship. For me, that was really good, because it wasn't just like, you know, if you hear me online again, you know, let me know. It's like, so we could call each other. So I'm like, okay, I'll meet you. And I was meeting him at a club in West Hollywood, and I told him I would be there like at 10 o'clock, and I got there like at 12:45 because I was getting ready. You know how that is. And I remember he told me what he was going to wear. He described himself. He wore exactly what he said. He looked like he was straight out of a heavy metal band. I wore something completely different because I was chicken shit, and I figured, well, if I don't like the way he physically looks, I just won't go up to him. And I remember going, well, fuck, good looking. And I went up to him, gave him a kiss, stuck my cigarette in his pocket, and we were together 5.5 years. And that night I introduced him to meth, and he was a West Hollywood cocaine boy. And, you know, he got really emotional, crying, paranoid. I was like, oh my God, you know. And, you know, and it just went on. So anyway, we got in this relationship, but about a year and a half, two years in, it's like the drink went flat, you know, the carbon. I'm like, this isn't working. And all of a sudden I thought, you know, Stephen, you need to go to therapy, because there's a lot of things that happened you haven't dealt with. You know, when I was young, my stepdad took a knife and stabbed my mom. That was very traumatic. You know, I need to go through all that. It was just traumatic. You can imagine paramedics, police, he went to jail, all of this craziness. And, you know, it was 30 years ago when now, you know, Raymond, with my partner, Raymond died of HIV. I was sitting next to his bed when they turned the respirator off. There was a lot of things that I'm like, I need therapy. So I called the Gay and Lesbian Center in West Hollywood, and I'm like, I need to come in for counseling or therapy, just attempt to try to get myself together. And so I filled out a questionnaire, and they're like, we're going to send you down to our addiction recovery department. And I was like, what? I was like, I didn't come here for that. I came here for some therapy. They're like, well, you're going to get it in the addiction recovery section. Thank God my higher power knew, or they recognized something that I didn't know. I didn't know I said I needed that. I just said I needed therapy. And actually what it was, I just needed someone to listen to my story, you know. Because I would come down, and then I would want you to listen to my story, and then I would cry, and you would offer suggestions, and I'm like, don't tell me how to run my life, and I'll go back out there, and, you know, and I'll do the same thing. And this counselor said to me, can you go 30 days without a drink or a drug? And I'm like, well, sure. No one's ever asked me to go 30 days without a drink or a drug. So I called my best friend Ricky, and I'm like, hey, Ricky, I'm going to quit drinking and doing drugs tomorrow. Let's go out and celebrate. So Ricky and I went out and tied one on, and it hadn't been fun in a long time, but I will have to say that was fun. And so the day one, I'm like, okay, day two, day three, day four, what are you looking at? You know, I was just like, I had no idea that I was detoxing. Detoxing from the drugs and the alcohol. It had a physical and it had emotional, it was everything. I did not know about that. And I made 30 days. And I'm like, see, I told you. Went back and started drinking. And this little voice says, why would that be the first thing you think about? I'm going to backtrack a little bit when I talked about Raymond, because I can see what I'm doing rather than being honest. I'm skipping past quickly the thing that changed my DNA. But anyway, I'll talk about Raymond. Raymond, I was in a bar in Pasadena. It was called On the Boulevard, and me and my friend were playing pool, or honestly, we were posing under the light of the pool table. So the pool table was here, but straight down there with the door so you could see who was coming in. So, you know, I'm sure I'm scratching up the table and doing all this shit. And the door opened, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that guy is going to be my lover. And my friend looks, he goes, oh, queen, he got the boyfriend. I'm like, so? I mean, what does that have to do with anything? So I met him, and I was living above the bar, in the apartment above the bar. So I invited him up, and I offered him my fluid of choice, which was gin. He goes, no, I just drink beer. I offered him my only nutritional substance, which was meth, or they called it crank at the time. And he goes, no, I just smoke pot. And I'm like, oh my God, this is great. I don't have to pretend I'm out, you know? I love it. He doesn't do the things I, you know? And we started this sexual relationship, and I can tell you, in the midst of all that insanity, true love occurred, but we did not know how to nourish it. And Raymond, eventually there was a knock at my door. I moved away from the bar because I need to not live right above a bar so I can try to control and manage my drinking. So let me move. You know, that just means you buy more. Well, that just meant I bought more at the store. But anyway, so I leave there. Raymond's at my house. And there's a knock at my door, and I open the door, and this guy's standing there, and he does one of these up and down, like, really? And he goes, here, you deal with him. It was Raymond's real lover. And he handed me two paper bags of the stuff that he decided, well, we're done. And I remember going, I am so psychic. I knew this guy was going to be my lover. What I did not pay attention to was, what did he mean by you deal with him? You know, because it's for me anyway, I can look back. There's a lot of things that I can tolerate in an affair. It's different if you're like the boyfriend or the husband. But anyway, Raymond's like, I'll be home at 6 o'clock. And I was that little boy when my stepdad got out of jail. He could come over and take us away for the weekend. And sometimes he would come, sometimes he wouldn't. I'm the youngest of five, so my brothers and sisters stopped waiting, but I was still waiting. One day he brought a bicycle over for my birthday, and then the following weekend he took it back because it belonged to his girlfriend's kid, you know? Yeah, so one day I'm sitting there. My mom didn't say anything. It was intuitive. I'm like, if you don't wait, Stephen, you won't be disappointed. So I remember getting up from the steps never to wait. So back to adulthood, I brought that skill with me. Raymond's like, I'll be home at 6 o'clock. I'm like, I don't wait. I don't plan. If you're here, great. This is how we're going to do this. If I'm here and you come, great. No pressure. Well, that was a good speech I made because at 6 o'clock I was waiting. 6:30 I was waiting. 7, 8, 9, 10. 12:45, he comes stumbling home in a blackout beer, drinking blackout. And I would be like, hell no. You gotta get your shit together. And, you know, I ain't putting up with this shit. And, you know, I can't love you until you learn to love yourself. I mean, oh my God, it was just, it was crazy. I'm going to bars and dragging him out of bars, and he's like, I don't remember. And I didn't understand or even believed at the time that there was such a thing as a blackout. Like, I don't remember. You know, and the reality of it is, I was so amped up on speed, I could tell you when that leaf fell off the tree. You know, so that's just the way it was. And, you know, we were a combination. He was a pure beer drinking alcoholic, so therefore, I could, you know, corner him in a chair and give my monologue. And he would, you know, he would just be like, you know, it was insane. It was insane. And then one day he came home and he goes, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that even kind of stunned me because, you know, I was ready with my speech. And I was like, and I remember going, well, that's good because, you know, we couldn't go on like this and sip and drink. And never were there truer words. His life changed and he needed to leave because I was in complete denial. After all, I didn't have a problem. I was the one telling him what he did. I was the one getting him out of the bar. I was the one, you know, nagging before he completely passed out and reminding him of what he may have forgot the next morning. So I didn't have a problem. And, you know, so he went on to Alcoholics Anonymous and things changed. And then where I was living, I needed to move in with him. And so I moved in with him, and this was back in 1985, between 85 and 87. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where I would say, hi, I'm Stephen. I am an addict, but not an alcoholic. And Raymond's life changed. This man who would say he would be home at 6 o'clock, he became so reliable. I just thought it was a given. He just became so reliable. And our lives got better. Where we lived got better. Our circumstances got better, and I know how far I was able to go by leaning 100% full weight on somebody who was getting sober and who was building his life on these principles. Now, Raymond was one of nine from a Mormon family, and he was doing the steps, and he was doing all of this work, and he was changing. And then one day he came home and says, "I'm having trouble breathing." And it got to the point where he could not walk from here to there without having to stop. And he had gone to clinics, and the clinics are like, well, you're dealing with family issues, and you're doing the steps, and this emotional stuff. I went to be tested for HIV, and I had lymph nodes that were like big, giant lemons on each side of my neck. And bless her heart, I remember this little nurse, "Well, sir, you know, African Americans, your hair is very nappy, so sometimes your lymph nodes get swollen." And I remember going, "You know what? I believe you." And, you know, and then it got to the point where a friend called the doctor he knew, and this doctor agreed to see Raymond and I, and we walked into the doctor's office, and the doctor says, "You have pneumocystis pneumonia," which was the AIDS-related pneumonia. And he goes, "I'm calling the county hospital. Go directly to the county hospital." So now we're in our, you know, 20s, late 20s, I was 25 at the time, Raymond was 27, and we go into the emergency room, and his family came from everywhere. They rallied around, his parents wanted to fly him to a private hospital in Hawaii, and he says, "I will not leave my partner." And he got out, he went back in, and this man wrote me a letter and said, it's funny because I'm preparing to move back to LA, and I was just rereading this letter the other day. And in the letter, it says, "Stephen, I understand if you can't see me every day. A note would be nice. I love you. Take care of you, know, all this stuff." But anyway, he was telling me, "I may not be able to keep that promise. I may not make it home because the percentage of people who come off the respirator are very low." A doctor walked in and said, "We need to put you on a respirator." And he looked up and said, "I need you to leave the room. I need to talk." He was trying to still take care of me. And so I was standing there when they turned the respirator off. And it changed my DNA. And I could remember quickly retreating into the one thing that I knew that I could survive with, anger. And I remember saying, it's almost as if I yelled it out loud, "No one or nothing will ever leave me again first." And I held it together for the memorial service, and then my life became drugs, sex, and strangers. Friends would call me up and say, "Hey, Stephen, you wanna go eat? Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Hey, do I owe you money?" They're like, "No." I'm like, "Then don't fucking tell me how to live my life." And my life became drugs, sex, and strangers. And I was living in Pasadena. I would go to the Rawhide Country Western Bar. Many of you know. I love a man in a cowboy hat and a big old buckle. That's just my thing. And I was on so much speed. I remember my friend from Oklahoma, Oklahoma Teddy Bear. He taught me how to two-step. And he was sloppy. "God damn it, you got too much disco in those hips." And so I would leave the Rawhide and go around to the job site, which was a bar where all the tweakers were fan dance. And then I would leave the, and I was on so much speed I couldn't even do the fan dancing. I was just like, come on, I'm all tangled. And then I would go up the street from there, which was a sex club called The Compound. And I had left my house on Thursday planning to go out for a drink. And they came up to me one day in that compound and said, "Sir, you have to leave." And I'm like, "Why? I paid to come in here." And they're like, "3 days ago, you know? And from what I hear now, I guess that's not a problem now, but then I guess they wanted me to pay again, so. I had gone to any lengths to get there. It had taken numerous buses from Pasadena. So now this strange thing has happened. I am forced out into the daylight against my will. And I come outside and the sun is up. I'm like, Jesus Christ. Because that place was like Vegas. They don't want you to know what day it is. You know. Some of you may know. And I remember having to get on this bus to get home. And I walk in on the bus and you turn and I'm going down. And this woman reaches out and I could see her pull her child closer to her. And I looked at her, I'm like, that effing B is racist. And I could see the other people on the bus, that little look like, oh my God, please don't sit here, please don't sit here. And I could see their noses cringe. And I remember looking around going, these people are sellouts. And you know, and I wasn't at Club Med, so you know, I was not shaved and I had spent 3 days in a sex club. And I remember having to convince myself with 100% of who I am. They were sellouts and they were racist because there was no way I could afford to see myself through the eyes that were looking back at me. And it talks about in our literature, there will come a time when we cannot differentiate the false from the real, and our using world becomes the only one we knew. I believe that with 100% of who I was, I had to. So, meet the guy on 976, meet him at the club, call the gay and lesbian center, see the counselor, can you go 30 days without a drink? So now we're I'm back to current. And so I go to meetings, only identifying as an addict. And I'm that type of addict where, you know, I know there's gonna be something that you say that I can use later. And at that time, I remember them saying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous had no opinion on outside issues. Now, anybody knows that's gonna come in handy. So I remember like, let me just put that in my pocket. And I later on hear somebody talk about they were taking a medication they needed. And I was sitting in a meeting and I was like, I had another intuitive thought. I'm like, I need that. So I went home, I called my doctor, and I'm like, I need this new non-addictive drug, and I gave him the name, because I'm under stress with my HIV. And he says, what pharmacy do you want me to call it into? And I took one every 5 minutes, and I drank my non-alcoholic beer as if it was the Fountain of Youth. And you know, and I got my 30-day chip and my 60-day chip, and I'm being very honest, and someone's like, well, I don't think you're sober, and I'm like, you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous had no opinion on outside issues. I'm like, you know what? My doctor wrote this prescription, so I don't really give a fuck what you think. And the reality of it is, I wrote the prescription. And the reason why I don't name the medication, there are people who I know who are sober who take it as needed and really do need it, so there's no need for me to name it. But I actually wrote that prescription. And I'm still hanging out with my old friends. My friends are being supportive. I'm still at a party with the guy I met on 976, and we're gonna get sober and save the relationship. And I remember going, shoot, I wanna get high, but I don't wanna be the weak one in the relationship to bring it up. So if Clay suggests getting high, then we'll get high. So, you know, automatically being a doctor myself, I decided he needed to start taking some of those pills I was taking. So every time I took one, I gave him one. And 2 seconds probably go by, and I'm like, screw it. If anybody offers me anything, I'm getting high. And my friends were nice. They were coming out of the bathroom going, are you good, Stephen? Do you got a soda? Are you all right? And I was going crazy. And there were the beers sitting on the table. I walk into this house. I pick up the beer. I take a drink, and I heard the words, bitch, you're playing a dangerous game. That was my higher power speaking to me in a language I get and very clearly. And I can tell you, as I describe it, and I really do mean it, it was the most disturbing freedom I'd ever been through in my life. I'm like, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And quickly, the voice was like, oh yeah. And that pill, you're taking one every 5 minutes, and that non-alcoholic beer you're guzzling, thinking that if you get enough of that 0.5, you'll get a buzz. You don't even like the taste. And I'm like looking around going, where is this coming from? These are not the thoughts that I have. And I remember going back to the therapist going, I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict. He goes, I know. But it didn't matter if he knew, I didn't know. That part, we must be convinced to a man that we're alcoholic. I didn't know. Now I know. Now I'm like the way they describe in the book. Now I am a man drowning and I am doing everything I can to get to the lifeboat. So I go back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I am there differently. I'm like, I need a sponsor, I need a sponsor. My first prayer, truth. I would go back and call my higher power truth or higher power. I need a sponsor, I need you to pick, because I will pick a man I want to have sex with, or I will pick someone that I think has a lot of money, and when they die, they will leave it to me. That was my prayer. And my higher power put someone in my life perfectly. And I went to this man, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I've done some horrible shit out there. He goes, Stephen, you're not on step four, you're on step one. I'm like, okay. He goes, all right, you admit you're powerless over drugs and alcohol and your life become unmanageable. I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, I stole this thing. And he's like, you're not on step nine, you're on step one. Let's talk about step one. We admitted we were powerless over drugs or an arcade crystal meth and our lives had become unmanageable. Between you and me, what do you mean by that? Well, you know, I threw up and I just like, yeah, yeah, that's great. Do you understand what you are confessing? He goes, I've watched you. You can't wait to get your hand up and go, hi, I'm Stephen, I'm an addict, alcoholic. What does it mean? Do you understand what you are confessing? Do you understand that if you do not drink or do drugs, you will get physically sober? But you need emotional and mental sobriety to stay here. You need the psychic change so that your thinking and when it comes to drugs and alcohol are different. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. He goes, no, let's talk about this. And he helped me understand what the addiction was. Then I got to two and three, and I was like, well, I'm a recovering this, and I used to name my mom's religion, and I no longer do it out of respect for her religion. My mom's religion works for her. I now say I don't practice the religion of my childhood, but I can guarantee you my mom did not go to some of the depths I went, and her spiritual belief helped her change certain things. There are people who go to certain, have certain religious practices I know in the rooms that they work perfectly for. You know, and the literature even suggests to be quick to see where religious folks are right, make use of what they have to offer. So me personally, I just say I no longer practice the religion of my childhood. But I found a higher power that I call truth, and I was able to start building my sound sobriety foundation on that. And then now it's time to do the fourth step. And of course now I don't want to do the fourth step. And so my sponsor's like, come on, you do the fourth step. So I remember doing my fourth step. I called my sponsor up. He set a time for me to meet him at his house. I remember he got up, went to the wall, and disconnected his house phone from the wall. And it shocked me. I'm like, oh my God, he's 100% present for me. And then my hands shaking, I proceed to read the three sentences I had written as my fourth step. And my sponsor's like, oh, sweetie. He's like, that's not your fourth step. He goes, that might be your inventory for the day, but that's not your fourth step. And then, you know, that knowledge we get here, I'm like, well, maybe I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. And he goes, no, people who are not holding this conversation. And so all of a sudden, the light went off. I'm like, I'm on the fourth step, not the fifth step. I'm going to write my fourth step as if I have no plan of ever doing a fifth step. It says we admit to God, to ourselves, and another human being. I'm like, can I do the first two? Can I admit to my higher power in myself? Forget another human being. I wrote down things I knew I was not telling you guys because I don't trust you. Yeah, me and my friends did some shitty, seedy things out there. But when a bitch cuts you out there, she cuts you looking at you. I'm walking in the rooms and I'm seeing character assassination. I'm like, I don't trust these people. I ain't telling them shit. So, but I'm gonna write it down anyway. So I wrote it all down. And when I was done, I asked my higher power, please lead me to a closed mouth person. Is my sponsor the person that should hear this? Have I seen him share with me things about my sponsee brothers or sisters? Have I seen him insult other addicts? And I didn't. So I'm like, okay. So I go to my sponsor and I read things to him that I swore were gonna go to my grave. I told him when I was at the Rawhide looking at the cowboy buckle in the hat, going to the job site, going to the sex club and they said, you gotta leave, that I knew at this point that I was HIV positive, the whole thing on the neck, forget it. And I was not holding conversations with people about that. Because when I was in the sex club, if you saw me and I saw you and we were attracted, come what may. And now I'm sitting in the rooms and I'm detoxing from drugs and alcohol. And I'm sitting there and literally I would go, because I'm recalling people, places, and things that are bringing so much shame. The only thing I know to take that away is the thing you say don't drink or use no matter what. And I shared with him in detail that stuff, and I let it come out. And I did not feel relieved. I was not floating on the clouds. I felt like I wanted to cut my wrist and stab myself in the forehead. And I held on. And my sponsor said things to me I wanted to believe. He talked about the grace of a higher power. He talked about you will see how your experience could benefit others. Well, I couldn't see it at that moment. And I remember being at a meeting on Fountain and Fairfax in Los Angeles. And it was a meeting where you come up to the podium and you share. And I raised my hand, and back then it was the first time I had ever raised my hand to share without planning what I was going to say. And I got up there and I shared with you, with the room, what I said to you. And as I got ready to sit down, my legs literally buckled on my way back to the chair. And then my head took off. He goes, oh, you are a crazy bitch. You're gonna share that shit in this room? Look at them. They're already talking about you. All that who you see here and what you hear here, let it stay here. Right. It's like, you know, and I was judging that based on what me and my friends were doing. Because we would leave a meeting and go, ooh, she's a sick one, you know. We were talking so much shit. And then I could hear my higher power voice say, Stephen, you must decide if your faith in me outweighs your fear of gossip. I must qualify this for if you're new. It says we share in a general way. I could have only shared it with my sponsor the way I did. I know people, that's what they do. I could have said, when I was drinking and using and going to the sex clubs, I did think to put myself in danger and others in danger. That works for a lot of people. I'm not asking for opinions, and I'm not asking for a show of hands on if I'm doing it the right way. Between me and my higher power, my amends to the faces I would never recognize. When you hear my story, you will hear in detail where this disease took me. You will hear in detail how I was a tornado through the lives of others. That is how I found my process with this amend. So whether you're here because the court sent you, or you're here because you know you belong here, this is my path. A woman shared when I first shared that, and I add to my share what she said because it was another gift. She raised her hand and said, I would like to speak to the women in the room. There may be times where you need to find a safe space to share so that you are not getting uninvited attention. And that goes for men or women. So we do have certain meetings that are maybe women's only or men's only or HIV positive or whatever it is, because we're sick people here getting well. And I love that, so I've added that. So that was the process. I also got to that fourth step. And I grant you, and I can tell you, that very same man that says you're not on step four, you're on step one. At 10 years, he had made a choice for himself that AA was no longer working for him. But I thank my higher power every day that in a human form, he used somebody to guide me there. So I still stand on a foundation that my higher power used him to set. And so I'm like, okay, I'm a sexual being. I used to say, I wouldn't have done that had I not been high. And it's like, well, what's your excuse now? You ain't high or drunk and you're doing some, you know. I mean, you're like Navya Comaneci. Well, that's from the 80s, the gymnast. And I'm like, okay. So I need to go back to my sexual, my fourth step. Resentment's easy. I'm resentful at this, yada, yada, yada. Fears. Now about sex. I get to have an inventory. And not only an inventory, an ideal. What do I want to do? You know? I want to swing from the chandelier. She should have had that song out when I was younger, but anyway. Anyway, I have a sexual ideal. And in this ideal, it's important for me that if I'm going to be sexually intimate with you, you get to decide if you want to participate knowing everything about me. I'm not into sex clubs anymore. What is my fear? My fear is that I'm going to be rejected. My fear is that you're not going to want me. And it's like, okay, if that fear is so great that I'm going to take away your right to choose. So I come up with an idea, and my higher power says, Stephen, why don't you let me weed out who should be in your life? So I had to balance it, because I can meet somebody and I can go, hi, my name is Stephen. I'm a recovering addict and alcoholic. I'm HIV positive. If you're going to go quickly. You know, and some people are like, oh, you want to go to dinner, or, you know, but anyway, So I get this information out. So I have this idea. At this phase of my sobriety, I am single. And I'm going to go out to a club, and I'm going to meet him. I don't know what his name is, but I know I'm going to meet him. And there's a couple of things I already know before I go out. I don't care about your mama, your daddy, your brothers, or your sisters. I am here for a sexual satisfaction and a sexual need. I'm going to disclose everything to you, and we're going to see if we're compatible. So I go to this club called Cuffs. The name tells you everything you need to know. And I go to Cuffs, and I meet him. And we go to my house that my higher power had gifted me in Silver Lake. And we go to my house, and I remember him saying, "Hey, do you mind if I smoke?" And I'm like, "Sure, go ahead." I truly thought he meant cigarettes. And he pulls out all of this paraphernalia, and I am like a deer in headlights, and I am staring so intently that it interrupts what he's doing. He goes, "Man, what are you staring at?" And I'm like, "I haven't seen anyone do this in years, and you know, I don't do this." Note, I did not say this is not gonna work, you have to leave. He does his thing, we do our thing, and when he leaves, I vacuum, I change the sheets. I'm going to make sure I'm not, you know, looking for a lint later. I vacuum. I change the sheets. I do all of that. And then I start giving myself that spiritual pat on the back. I'm the man. I'm so sober. I'm not tempted. I've had a psychic change. I did not do it. And then I hear my higher power again very clearly saying, "Stephen, do not mistake God's grace for personal strength." And I was like, wow. So I go back to my sexual ideal. Am I willing to walk away from a piece of ass because, or am I not? How do I say thank you to my higher power? You have delivered me from this disease, and I am still sleeping with it. I don't say, when I got here, and I know I need to wrap up soon. When I got here, I would hear people say, "Lower companions," and I know what people mean. You know, when I was drinking or using, I would wake up with gargantula or, you know, lower companions. And I would go to meetings and I would say the same thing. And my higher power said to me, because my higher power speaks to me very clearly, it's like, "Stephen, I need you to cut the shit. There's no such thing in your life as a lower companion. The only thing you had was an inability to practice personal preference. But don't refer to my children as lower companions." And so, meth, alcohol, and drugs took away my ability to have personal preference. I know what it's like to be the person who, quote unquote, sober, laying in bed with somebody and seeing them come from wherever they are and try to figure out, how did I get here and who are you? And I have decided that I need, and I didn't decide, I was like, wow, you recognize what's going on here. Lower companion, inability to practice personal preference, they did not choose you. Their high chose you. And I don't want that feeling, personally. And when I was, my first couple of years, I was hooking up with people who were not just a little drunk, they were spun. And why? Because I did not have my voice around sex. I did not know how to hold that conversation. I come from the world where you just jump in and I'm going to do what I want to do, and if you don't like it, if you're able to, you'll stop me, or vice versa, and we just do it. Now I'm like, what are you into? Do you top? Do you bottom? Are you kink? Are you holding conversations? And I needed to develop that. And I had to act my higher power to help me develop that. And so my life has changed. What is it like now at 26 years or 10 months? I'm getting ready to return to Southern California. I'm 55 years old and I'm like, you know, sobriety has taught me you can have roots and wings. So I understand that. But I'm like, I don't know if my roots need to go any further here. And plus, you know, I think I might need more sunshine. I'm blessed. I can get there and be like, you know what, I'm changing my mind and come back. But it is the change. What will I do? I got sober there, and whether I was going there or anywhere, I would know where the meetings are. I still call my sponsor and I tell him my disease. My addiction has not gone away. It's only changed form. And I ask myself, what form is it in today? So if you're new, or even if you're not new, I try to use that everyday language. You know, it talks about anonymity. I didn't even know what that meant. You know, who you see here, what you hear here, let it stay here. Well, that's great. If you're new, you can go up and say, "Hey, bitch, can you keep your mouth shut? I got something on my chest that's going to kill my ass, and I need to let it out." If you can't keep your mouth shut, no bad. Just do me a favor and give me the gift of being honest about it. I tell my sponsees, I pray to my higher power never to reference or use anything they say. That's very, very important. When I see someone on the street who might be in their act of addiction, I won't be going, ooh, girl, she's a mess, look at her. I say, but for the grace of God, I used to be that person. You guys saved me from drowning, and then I would go out there and call someone a mess and go, look at her. What is that? How can you save me and then me tease or judge the person who has not been graced with that? I share that about what I did because I am changing that now. I silently, if anything, say, but for the grace of God, and please provide them everything that they need. I am not my sponsee's higher power. I have, like I said, I have made mistakes here, you know, and I loved it in the boundary meeting, and thank you both to the gentleman who spoke. Lindy had said, and I record her saying, you can't get an A in AA. What a wonderful thing, you know? It is so true. I will end with this. I know the difference between a lifeboat and a cruise ship. And when I am in the mindset that this is a lifeboat, I am humbled and I am grateful. I also know the difference between falling apart and falling together. Thank you for catching me. Thank you.